found myself in a conversation about Nova Scotia the other day. Unexpectedly, of course, not a place that comes up in conversation in my life a whole lot, perhaps if I lived in Halifax, yet I don't. But when on the rare occasion Nova Scotia does come up, I always think of a song I heard a very, very long time ago, like decades ago, that I don't think I've heard since. And in that song, a guy sings, "You're in New York, but I'm not. You're in Tokyo, but I'm not. You're in Nova Scotia, but I'm not." Always stuck with me, that song, because why Nova Scotia? It's odd and funny. There's some deliberate comedy in there, but stayed with me. But what I was wondering just the other day in this Nova Scotia conversation, who was singing that? Who was that band? What was that song? So when the conversation was completed, I thought, I'm going to figure that out. I picked up my iPhone. I Googled, "You're in Nova," and then the autofill offered Scotia, but I'm not. Followed the link, and it gave me all the information about the song "Everywhere That I'm Not" by the band Translator, 1982. Translator is from San Francisco. They still play together sometimes. Being able to get that information instantly into my hand and up to my eyes and brain, that is neat. It's really very cool, and I love it. I'd rather have the internet than not have it. It's how you get this show, after all. It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. The internet is powerful, but with great power comes a great number of complete assholes. Jerks aplenty, with a very low entry point to distributing cruel comments, bigotry, hatred, bullying, all sorts of things. It's easy for them to do, and so they do it a lot. And this experience, encountering this stuff, reading this stuff, absorbing it, can be draining and painful. It can impair your mental health. It's a huge tax that we are all asked to pay for all the good stuff online. So we have to either put up with the jerks or expend the effort to avoid them. Those are our two choices. There is, however, a third way. Engage with the jerks, the bullies, the assholes. And many people do this by being combative in response, trying to cause as much pain back at the jerks as the jerks had put out there in the first place. Now, this is an understandable reaction, but it rarely solves much. It usually just makes things even messier. And then there's Dylan Maron's approach. Polite, inquisitive conversation with people who have been very, very rude. Dylan is the author of the new book, Conversations with People Who Hate Me, and creator and host of the podcast of the same name. His approach all started when he was making and starring in comedy videos that became very popular, widely seen.
I started getting big with digital videos, and I was getting a kind of torrent of online hate comments. And these were comments beneath the videos. These were direct messages. In the rare, rare case, it was an email. And I kind of didn't even know how to even start processing this. And so my first instinct was to start collecting them. I would take screenshots. I would file them away into my hate folder on my desktop. And eventually that folder grew and grew and grew.
An example of some of the messages that went into that folder.
You know, the truth is I can open the actual hate folder here for you.
You still have it on the desktop.
I have it. It's on because I needed it for all the fact checking for my book.
Sure.
So
it's like an old friend.
It's an old friend. And it's also like, it also feels famous to me because like in the book, it's written as the all caps thing that it is. And here on my computer, believe it or not, it's the hate folder from the original days.
Wow.
Okay. Let me give you some good ones. I'll just scroll through. First one I clicked, "fucking fags," referring to me and perhaps who I was interviewing. Let's see. Oh my God, this one I can't even read. So someone wrote, "You are a disgrace to humanity, and not because you are gay," which I absolutely love because he wants to be clear that his hatred of me is not rooted in homophobia.
Right.
You know?
It's a different sort of hate.
It's a different sort of hate. This guy goes to the pride parades, honey. This guy is an ally. He believes trans rights are human rights. And yet...
He hates you for other specific reasons.
And I love that. That is diversity of hate. I had made a video commenting on masculinity, and someone said, if you get caught in a house fire, you'll be begging for a masculine guy to come and save you, which is like, are you describing a hope or perhaps a fantasy? And let's see. We got to end on this one. Just a simple DM. Fuck you.
Elegant. The classics.
And I have to say, I think, you know, what I just read aloud there was clearly veered more on the homophobic, which that was a random sample. So this is, in fact, most of what I was getting. But there was some, you know, hate from people who agreed with me on many things. And there was also some constructive criticism that gets lumped into hate because that's how our minds browse the internet, and this is something we're dealing with.
Was the idea of compiling these into a folder for later reference, I imagine as a performer and as a video maker, someone who creates, you thought maybe this could turn into something, you could use this. Was it also a process of owning it, of like, you know, you're going to use that as a weapon against me, I'm going to reclaim it and laugh at it and empower myself?
It definitely the latter. The truth is, and I'm always down to show any like backstage planning stuff, but the truth is I didn't really know what I was doing with these. It was really more instinct that I was trying to collect them just because it felt like I could gain a little control over them if I had a screenshot of it on my desktop. But you're definitely on the money with the fact that I would do the normal thing, which is to post pictures of them. And by normal thing, I think I just mean something you see a lot in the digital public square, which is that people frequently repurpose their hate comments to make fun of them, just as I did. It doesn't really leave you. So just as I read those aloud to you, like I had to make jokes about them. They're just too sad and too devastating to just take on their own. And so, you know, saying that the guy who said I was a disgrace and not because I'm gay, it's like, that still sucks to read. It's funny to think of him as this ally who hates me, but it's what our minds have to do to cope with this stuff. And we, as a human species, I think are so new. Our brains have not yet adapted to the internet. We do not yet know how to process all that the internet brings. And that means the good stuff too. That also means the massive scale of negativity that I don't think we were ever prepared for.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like trauma, right? Here's something that evolutionarily as a species, we're not equipped to process, you know, like we can't process a stranger under a fake name who could be anywhere in the world making personal attacks. We can't process a million people having died of COVID and what all that means. I've always been a big believer that the technology outpaces our ability to deal with the technology.
Oh, that's perfectly said. I completely agree.
And then it's not unusual, I think, for people, especially in the creative sphere, to get hateful comments. And and obviously it's not unusual for people who are LGBTQ to get homophobic comments. Mm-hmm. What is unusual a little bit is to set up interviews with people and make it into a podcast. How did that come about? Because that's at the heart of the Conversations with People Who Hate Me podcast.
Yeah. So I'll give you the quickest version of telling this story. One very important detail about these comments is that I was making videos from about 2016 to 2017 specifically for Facebook. They were also being posted on YouTube, but they were gaining most popularity on Facebook in that window of time when Facebook video was it, when we all thought, like, this is the new video service. And I share that with you because whenever I got a DM, whenever I got a comment, you can often click on that person's profile and you are taken on an immediate portal into, in some cases, and I would say in many cases, hundreds of pictures of them, links to family members, details about them that you would never have gotten, and pictures that they post of themselves. So images that they want to project out into the world of themselves. YouTube is a different beast, right? YouTube, so many comments are anonymous. You go and it's not linked to a decade of biographical data that you've been giving to this website. But Facebook, just like being, catching it at that sliver of time, or getting popular at that sliver of time on that platform, allowed me to kind of take a deep dive into these people's lives. And a coping mechanism other than simply collecting screenshots of this hate was I needed to convince myself that these people who were sending me these things were human. And so I would kind of fictionalize, like I would essentially write fan fiction of these people, of their lives, using the what they had available of their biographical data. And I would kind of weave a story between it. So I would connect one picture to another. I would call upon the cast of characters of their lives, of the people who had commented on their pictures and the people listed in their bio as their family members. And this is not the way I describe it. It sounds like I sat down with like a quill and paper and I wrote this like beautiful story. But it was really just like it was all in the scroll. It was all in like I would spend a lot of time on their profiles because I needed to know that they were human beings. The closest I can come to understanding that coping mechanism is that when I understood that they were human beings, they felt like people that I could reach rather than these like distant monsters who had hurt me. And then that kind of created an inroad, even if just in my mind. So again, speeding this story up, but giving you all the details, I was doing comedy shows at the time, and I did exactly what you referred to earlier. I was sharing screenshots from the hate folder, making fun of typos, pointing flaws in faulty logic, and then I filmed that, of course, redacting last names and blurring photos. I filmed that. I filmed one of these comedy shows where I did that. I put it up on Facebook. And one of the people in the slideshow recognized himself in the slideshow, and he messaged me, and we spoke the next day. And this call was unrecorded, the first phone call we had. And I remember having this distinct feeling that I was experiencing the next level of all these fictional backstories that I was weaving. Like now it wasn't fictional. Now I could speak to the person whose life I was imagining. I think it also helped, it needs to be said, he had said something very homophobic to me with a few other digs at me. But on the phone, I could tell that he was this really sweet kid. He was in high school at the time. He was like, this 18-year-old high school senior.
This is Josh, I believe, right?
This is Josh. And he was, and is, but speaking in the past tense, he was sweet and he was apologetic, but he was also curious and he was also kind. And talking to him, and again, I think it helped that he was this like special person who could have this conversation and was interested in having this conversation. It made me want to do this with more people in the hate folder. And so began the social experiment / podcast / project conversations with people who hate me.
And what did that do to your mental health? The idea of, you know, getting these comments, somebody appearing as a very simple negative thing and then opening up to all the complexity. And sometimes they continued to be homophobic. Sometimes they continued to be a difficult person. But how did that affect you mentally and emotionally?
You know, I think the really big misunderstanding about the mental health toll that this show takes on me is that people, and I'm including people who know me really, really well, the misunderstanding is that the mental health toll happens with the conversation. How can you have these conversations? How can you handle these conversations? And the truth is, the conversations are hands down my favorite part. Like, they are the pearl that I work for.
They're the payoff.
They're the payoff. And it's also like, I want to be very respectful when I say this. I'm not necessarily a religious person, and I don't mean this as a joke. Both are true at the same time. But it really feels like you are experiencing the divine in these calls. Like, that you are building a bridge with someone who you met on a platform that doesn't really sustain bridges, and people who are so different from you, and also, as you know, I'm interested in too, people who are really not different from you, but still are like incensed by something that you did or said. The conversations give me total hope in the world and our ability to speak to each other. Hearing a person who said something homophobic to me even say hi to me on the phone is transcendent. Or talking about mundane things like how their day is going, you just feel like this is incredible. The emotional toll of this show is everything that precedes the conversation and everything that follows the conversation. So, you know, I have dug myself into a hole because I have decided to do a podcast that is just impossible to produce. I am doing a show probably similar to what you experience, but it is a chore to convince people to be on this show, which is also like sad. You know, like when you're like, you're trying to argue on behalf of this thing that you have devoted your life to and convince them to be on this show to, because now, of course, I mostly moderate conversations between people because we ran out of diversity in the hate folder to create new episodes. And then on the back end, there's kind of two things that create a really heavy emotional toll. One is in the editing. Often I'm left with 4 hours, 4+ hours of tape. And wow. In the edit, I have to honor three things in the edit. One, I have to honor the audience. I have to create something that is digestible. I don't want to send out a 4-hour and 12-minute recording into right. People's ears.
A lot of podcasters do that, and thank you.
A lot of podcasters do that, but those I find to be more comedy ones where you're like, it's like two professionals who are like, we know the art of conversation, whereas like there's a lot of stumbling and starting and figuring out who we are. So I have to honor the audience. I have to honor my guests because I need to obviously represent how the conversation went, but I also need to make sure that if they want to be anonymous, as many guests do, that I'm editing out every detail that could be identifiable. Their ideas as they presented them are coming across as clearly as possible. But the third thing I need to honor is the truth. How did the conversation go? And so when you're honoring all those things in the edit, that's really complicated. It takes a really, really long time to both give an accurate representation of what happened and to honor all of those things. Then I would say the bigger macro source of my exhaustion is that I feel like we are living in a time when cynicism is reigning supreme on social media. And social media has been increasingly a harder and harder place for me to be. And sometimes this cynicism is totally legit and it is totally earned. And people find the hopefulness of conversation and the hopeful message of my show to either be eye-rolly and basic and cheesy and, dare I say, choogy, you know? And then other people, and this includes, you know, some great minds that I really respect, are critical of the show for we need far more than conversations. Conversations cannot undo all of the ills that are plaguing our world right now. And so much of my energy internally is spent kind of feeling like a little alone in this project. Like, to be trying to build bridges on the internet, on social media, it feels like not the most popular thing these days.
You're outnumbered because there's so many more people burning down bridges.
Completely. And these platforms allow for that, which is why I never want to blame any individual person. But it's like, these platforms don't make conversation even like possible, or like, it is why it's so hard to produce this show, because you're like trying to extract people from these platforms that are consistently dehumanizing us and into a space where you can get to know someone more, and people are terrified of it because they're not used to it anymore. More and more, these platforms are separating us from each other. So the project feels lonely. Lonely ideologically, and lonely in terms of, I mean, I make it myself, and it feels, I was thinking about that as I was in my depression mode deep dive, which is like, there's some totally legitimate critique that conversation is not going to solve all of our problems. And to that I say, of course not. Like, of course conversation will not solve all of our problems. But no one form of activism will solve all of our problems. It is a tile in the mosaic. It is a brick in the path. Choose your metaphor. It's a patch in the quilt. It's part of it.
Coming up, why talk to hateful people at all? Why give hate yet more of a platform? Back with Dylan Marin, who has made a career out of reaching out to online haters and saying, hi, hello, would you like to be on my podcast? How are you? Could it be actually counterproductive, though? And I'm just totally devil's advocate on this. But
no.
I mean, in the book, you discover some of the pain that people have, the complexity, and they say these things. Part of me was wondering, well, why talk to them at all? Why give... You know, somebody who is going to call you an F word, a term mm-hmm. for homosexual person online, why give them any more oxygen than they're already having? Like, they're already, why not just obliterate them as much as possible from the discourse?
Well, I get where you're coming from. And trust me, many friends have asked me the same question. The question about why give them oxygen, why not obliterate them, is that I think that we misunderstand what obliteration even means. Like, these ideologies exist in the world. And, you know, homophobia is around. Has it evolved since I was a teenager? And was it then an evolved form of what it was when I was just being born into this world in the late 80s? Totally. But there is an undercurrent of homophobia that is still around. I think that we have been kind of reprogrammed to think that by roasting someone, devastatingly roasting someone, saying something negative about their physical appearance, or saying how dumb they are publicly in the digital public square, that we are, in doing that, also obliterating this ideology that we find to be harmful. By making fun of the person who espoused homophobia, we are eradicating homophobia. And I do not believe that that is true. I think one of the most important things we can do is understand how these ideologies grow in people, because they grow in human beings who were not born with these ideologies, but human beings who harvested these seeds or had these seeds harvested for them by people they look to. And, you know, what I'm always after in my interviews is not changing someone's mind, because that can't happen in the course of a phone call. I can't undo decades of learning in a 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour call. I just can't. You can, however, plant a seed for someone for them to maybe reconsider something. But them harvesting that seed, them tending to that seed, all of that is not part of my control. I am not able to shepherd them through the rest of their life. I can be as present as possible for the space of our conversation. I can create as safe a space as possible, but I cannot undo what happened before, and I can't monitor what happens after. I think the value in conversation is planting a seed, hoping that they tend to it, making them feel as comfortable as possible, and then also by projecting these conversations out into the world through the podcast platform, you know, a lot of people are having these conversations. And in the physical realm, it's a lot harder to obliterate someone, right? Especially, I'm speaking personally for homophobia, like I'm speaking personally on behalf of homophobia. This is my sponsor.
Congratulations on getting that gig,
you.
By the way.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break so we can hear from our sponsor, homophobia. No, but to speak specifically to homophobia, to the issue of homophobia, all of these ways that we can destroy someone on Twitter for being homophobic, that goes out the window when you're in the physical realm and someone is shouting gay slurs at you. You are not in the space to obliterate or destroy them. Or when you're in the physical realm with a family member who is not shouting homophobic slurs at you, but you have this like continued undercurrent of homophobia in your relationship with them. These conversations are happening all over the world. Difficult conversations are happening, and obliteration is never part of the solution. It seems to be part of the solution in the public square because it's so entertaining and we mistake that for change.
Right. And it's punching up also, you know, like if.
Yeah. Well, it feels like punching up. And I think, listen, I think I'm going a little too far down this road of talking about how obliterating and destroying people online doesn't work, because I think, you know, especially for marginalized communities, there's such a necessary catharsis to see a transgressor pay for their crimes publicly. And I get that. I get that because when I see someone who I think has done profoundly wrong, like I want to see them know that they have done wrong. I think what I'm just trying to say is that in practice, it's a little more complicated because what does that transgressor then go and do? Does that actually change them, or does that just get the cheers of the people who you're trying to defend, which is super important? But if we have a mind to like more repair, more of a sense of repairing relationships rather than simply boosting our own side, that's the stuff I'm thinking about with the show.
Do you agree with Anne Frank that most people are good after all?
Well,
I think she even said that everyone was good after all.
I agree in the sense that I think at core, there is at center of most people's souls, I have to say most because I haven't met every person in the world. I don't know every soul, but so leaving room for error. I do think that most people have that capability in them. Now, of course, as I say this, listeners are scrolling in their heads thinking about all the exceptions to this rule.
You've given a good caveat, though, too. Do you think that more so since you started doing this project than you did before?
Well, I think I launched into this project with that belief. And I also think, like, everyone I've met in this project corroborates that. But, and you know, to add to the caveat, is that I think that there are a lot of people who have endured really traumatic things in their life, and they can only put that trauma on other people. And there are people who have walls up that didn't experience trauma. There are people who do really, truly evil and heinous things and didn't experience trauma. So while, yes, I do agree that at core, most people are good. I also think that it's because that statement is true, it doesn't mean we need to readily forgive people who cause great harm and who do great harm. And both of those things can be true at the same time. That at core, people are good and you can find the goodness in people, but sometimes that's a long road into the center of their soul to find that goodness because, and listen, there are explainable things for all of this. Maybe they're very hurt. Maybe they have been taught incredibly dangerous things and their whole community upholds these very dangerous ideas, or a whole variety of other reasons. But it can't be used as like a way to evade ownership. What's the word I'm looking for?
Responsibility, culpability.
Responsibility. Yeah, it can't be used as a way to evade responsibility for real harm that's caused to people.
Just ahead, what is the mental health toll when you marinate in hate and negativity? Dylan Marin does this as part of his job, but we all run the risk of it when we use the internet.
Hi, I'm Biz, host of One Bad Mother. Whether you're a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent.
I signed my stepson up for a camp that is actually in another state. I feel really stupid, and I don't think we're going to get the money back.
And then he found out that the car manual is a book about cars, so now he's reading our car manual.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job. Download One Bad Mother on MaximumFun.org, and yes, there will be swears.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Travelle Anderson.
And I'm Jared Hill. We are the hosts of Fanti, the show where we have complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the things that we really, really love sometimes, but also have some problematic feelings about.
Yes, we get into it all. You want to know our thoughts about Nicki Minaj and all her foolishness? We got you. You want to know our thoughts about gentrification and perhaps some positive aspects of gentrification? We get into that too. Every single Thursday, you can check us out at MaximumFun.org. Listen, you know you want it, honey, so come on and get it. Period.
Now, I'm somebody who talks about mental health problems for a living, and I've been doing this for several years now. My profession is all about marinating in trauma and depression and anxiety, and it can be really hard on me. And I really think about what it's doing to me a lot. I give that some thought. I have conversations about it. My line that I tell people is that everything I'm doing is a comeback story, because I'm talking to people who maybe have found better ways to control their mental health issues, or I'm just talking to people who are in rough shape but are sharing it, are expressing it, are putting it into words, which is an act of healing, at least one step in a good direction. And that notion helps me, that these are comeback stories. Doesn't, you know, I'm still like, oh shit, this is some heavy stuff. You know, like it can still really weigh on me. How does that go for you? Like, how do you take care of yourself in, you know, making some of these hateful comments part of your job and part of your professional life and part of your livelihood? How do you cope with that?
You know, I'm going to give you the most honest answer, which is I really don't know. Like, I get this question frequently, and it's often asked at a lecture by a very kind college student who asks, like, how I practice self-care.
Yes.
And, you know, the funny thing is, I'm such an advocate of self-care for other people, and I want to be clear, I'm not answering this to sound like any sort of saint or any sort of, like, hardened person who doesn't need self-care. Like, I very much do need self-care. Well, I can tell you how this manifests in a totally different part of my life, and maybe hopefully we'll get to some new truth here that I have yet to unearth, and we're going to unearth it live here on Depresh Mode. So totally unrelated corollary that I think is related. I never want to drink water, ever. Like, I do not enjoy drinking water. I don't even think to drink water until I am so parched. My pee is just like neon yellow. Like, it is like we have reached the point of no return. I'm like, why is my mouth dry? And I'm like, oh my God, right. I actually haven't had water in like maybe days. And I just don't think about it until it's the last moment. And I'm like, ah, fuck. Okay, water, 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 water. And then I go and I have to gulp two glasses because I forget or have forgotten. And I think the self-care that I practice for this show is the same thing. And I never really recognize it. Or the self-care I practice or don't practice for this show works the same way. Because I always kind of like dissociate whenever this question is asked to me because I really don't know. And the truth is, there are morsels of answers. I watch home improvement shows. Oh my God, this is, again, not sponsored, but this is the most relaxing thing I've found. There is a subgenre of YouTube videos of car detailers. People who just detail cars. And this is a shout out. I don't know this person. This person doesn't know I exist. And so this is not a promo. This is just an honest me telling you something I love. But there's this vlogger called The Detail Geek, and he's Canadian and he cleans cars. And it's these like 40-minute videos of him deep cleaning a car. And I put one on Saturday night after doing a lot of editing work. And I just like, my body relaxed. I like watching home improvement shows. I like watching live performances from pop stars at awards shows. Like, these are the kind of things I do to relax. So that's the kind of simple answer for self-care. But I never think that I'm getting too overwhelmed until I need to gulp two glasses of water, until I burn out so much that I have a day set aside to do 10 hours of work, and I literally just lie on the couch staring at the ceiling. And I don't know. So I, forgive me, but I have to ask this question to you is, like, honestly, how do you deal with it? And I'm not asking as a kind of interviewee becoming the interviewer. I'm like, please help.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the glib answer is Bigfoot videos. I can't get enough Sasquatch videos.
Oh my God.
And I've seen the same ones over and over, or they'll be like, oh, here's a new one. Oh, it's using that clip from that other one that I've seen.
Yeah.
I saw a fresh one yesterday, and it really was a game changer. Because I grew up in the Pacific Northwest being afraid of Bigfoot, because that's where it's most commonly reported is in that area. But it also represented a possible other world that existed that wasn't the world I was living in. It was very promising. Yeah. But in a larger sense, I don't know. I do think it wears on me. I mean, I recently had occasion to do a sort of side podcast project with some young people, some college students, that wasn't about mental health at all. And it was a real tonic. You know, it was like, I don't have to. And because I am who I am, a lot of them just started bringing it up anyway. And, you know, and that was fine. But no, I mean, I try to compartmentalize it. I try to close the office door. I work from home, but I try to close the door to the room where I do all this stuff.
You're talking metaphorically or literally?
Literally, yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I'm in my
like
office.
Like, I see the door closed
studio.
Behind you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know how well I do. I mean, I feel like I'm emboldened by the work that I do. I want to do it forever. Mm. But I know that it takes a toll as well. I mean, I imagine it's probably not all that different from like athletes who, like, you know, they know there's wear and tear on the body, but they want to keep doing this for as long as possible.
Yeah. I think with athletes, there's such a tradition of it that you kind of like under, like there's a, because it's manifested physically and not just psychologically, that there's a visible wear and tear on the body, and there's an understanding of retirement, and there is like an understanding of when you retire and what you do when you retire. Whereas I think it's a little more difficult to pinpoint for girls like us, you know, who are doing these like kind of heavy lift.
I'll tell you though,
heavy emotional lift projects.
Aren't you interested in coaching though? Like, I'm really interested in helping other people make their shows. And the older I get and the further I get into this, the more I think about that.
Yeah, I definitely think that. I think what I crave is like, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but I do, it does feel lonely to do this work. And this is not to disrespect the wonderful listeners that my show has and the really amazing ways people have shared that this has touched their lives. But I think it feels lonely, and this is related, not a tangent, but doing this show, trying to find a solve to the dehumanization of the internet has, to produce it, you have to spend a lot of time on the internet.
Yeah.
And it's become an increasingly hard place for me because I think, you know, when I was making videos, I was really succeeding at the game of the internet. And now that I'm doing a project, devoting myself to a project that questions the dehumanization of it, you essentially are retiring from the game of the internet. I think that's like, it brings about all the parts of myself that I'm really not thrilled with, the jealousy, the envy, the comparison. I mean, these are just comparison machines, right? And I say this while also contending with the fact that people also compare themselves to me. So like, I do it to other people do it to me, and it kind of feels like there are no winners because everyone is just comparing themselves to everyone else. And so when I say it feels lonely, I mean that, believe it or not, this is actually all related to answer your question, which is that I would like to coach people. And I think in some ways, like writing the book was that for me in terms of being like, this is what I learned. I hope what I learned helps you, reader. But I also think I want to not feel so isolated in it. I want to work with a team. Like, I dream of, you know, having like, because it's really hard to scroll the internet searching for stories and then to be reaching out for stories, reaching out to people with the hope of producing these stories into episodes. And I dream of like having a big room where a lot of people are working alongside me, and there are a lot of interpersonal physical realm check-ins where we're all like working on things together so that this very ephemeral digital world feels like, well, we got a team here and we're figuring it out. But really the team is what you're seeing right now, which is like me in my sweats on my phone, messaging someone, making myself available for a potential guest to maybe call me with questions so that they can maybe then think about doing the show. And so I don't know. I'm of two minds. I agree with what you said, which is that like, or I feel the same way as what you just said, which is that I do want to do this forever. And then I also need to learn how to hydrate myself, continuing the water metaphor. Like, I don't know, because I never can really pinpoint what the source of the burnout is.
Yeah. And in that bright, airy loft of an office space that you talk about with all those nice people, there's going to be
lots of windows, sun pouring in. Yeah.
Water cooler. See?
Oh, my God.
Right?
That's, yeah.
I'll twist your metaphor there a little bit.
No. I love the water cooler, or I just have an IV into me so that I never have to think about drinking
just
water.
Great bags hanging from the ceiling. Now, yeah. A lot of people are going to encounter meanness, cruelty, even hate online.
Yeah.
It's a it can be a terrible place and it can be a very vicious place. What have you learned about the best way to handle it when it happens?
Gosh, this is truly such a big question. It's a great question, but a very big one. So especially with online hate, I think the most important thing is to remind ourselves of its scale, right? Like, I think sometimes 3 negative comments at you can feel like the world hates you. And I think it's very important to take a beat, breathe, look at the actual numbers. Is it 3 people? You know, and sometimes if someone has written a tweet and then 17 people like it, you're like, okay, it's actually the entire Milky Way galaxy hates me. So kind of getting a better sense of scale, which is really hard to do when we're just in our little rabbit holes on our phones, like the vortex where this is the world and this is the entire world that we see. I also think like one of the most troubling forms of hate that presents itself online is the kind of main character pylon we see happen on Twitter so frequently, and especially when it's apolitical, right? When there's not a political harm that a private citizen has done, but simply they just have done something that there's enough traction that enough people think it's the dumbest fucking thing they've ever seen.
And that attracts more attention and
Yeah, more and more attention, because then you both gain a sense of belonging by joining that pylon. Well, you must be doing something right if you're making this joke along with other people. And it's a way to earn points in the game of the internet. But I think what point is the hate serving? If it's just for sport, there's really no use to that. If it's born out of what you would call a legitimate anger, thinking of an example, it's like if it's quote unquote hate coming from someone who has been routinely beaten down by the system and they are taking a politician to task, that's different. Politicians sign up for life in the public square where they are beholden to their constituents. Now, a lot can be said about how sometimes we take local politicians to task in neighborhoods that we do not live. And so what does that conversation mean? It's another time, another podcast, another conversation. Scale, questioning the purpose of the hate. And also, I'm repeating the tagline I say at the end of every episode, but it bears repeating. It's the reason it is the tagline. But at the end of every episode, I say, remember, there's a human on the other side of the screen. And that goes both ways. That is both for when you are about to fling the hate, right? Like that person who you're about to say that really nasty thing to, even if you think they really deserve it, that's a human being with feelings. And then the more complicated version of that, or the more complicated twist of that, is that the person who wrote you that hate is also a human being who was motivated by these twisted platforms to think that sending you that hate was worthwhile, or that you would never see it, so they're just sending it into a void, you know. So kind of tethering ourselves to the humanity in the digital sphere that strips us of humanity and strips other people of humanity is, I think, one of the most important things and one of the most important shields to to arm ourselves with as we go into the public square every day, digital public square every day.
Dylan Marin, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for talking to us here, and best of luck out in the sometimes choppy shark infested ocean of the internet and of literature.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've said this to you off mic, but I am a big fan of your show, and I'm a big fan of you, and I'm a big fan of what you're doing. So it was an honor to be here.
Yay.
Yay.
Dylan's work and the way he interacts with the internet is probably not like yours. It's probably more extreme and public-facing than yours, but I think a lot of the fundamentals of his interaction with the internet are essentially the same. You go to a place, the internet, where everyone either is or potentially could be. you very often say something, and anyone can come back at you and say just about anything. It's amazing, and sometimes wonderful, and sometimes very much not wonderful. And often it's devoid of tone, and it's inherently depersonalized, and it's just hard. I hope you don't get online haters. If you do, I don't expect you'll reach out to them and arrange interviews. Dylan is a whole different cat in that regard. But I do think his work teaches us something about existing in the world with other people, both the online world and the meat space world. People have reasons to do and say what they do and say. And the really intensely negative stuff often comes from a place of fear or pain. And I think some of the people who are the most afraid and in the most pain look for ways to throw that fear and pain at others. And a digital representation of a stranger seems like a good place to do that, so they fling away and ignore that there's another person back there as well, with their own reasoning and motivation and human story. There are just human beings every place, you guys. It's easy to forget. But perhaps easiest to forget online. Also, Everywhere That I'm Not by Translator, cool song. Go check it out. And now it's the time of our show that we're joined by two very important guests. One is Laura House, who's a host of Tiny Victories, a co-host of the Tiny Victories podcast here on Maximum Fun. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
And the second guest, of course, is Your Breath.
I was hoping that's who it would be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a celebrity, but a very important part of the meditation. And maybe somebody who our listeners aren't all that familiar with. They might not be well-versed in their own breath, but boy, it could be the key to so much, can't it?
Yeah. It's not something we're thinking about all the time. And there's ways to meditate where you have a word or a phrase or a thought or a, you know, there's various sounds or different things. And there's something so great and simple about, well, it's your breath. Like, it's right there. Like, it's right. It's almost, I wouldn't say always, but it's sometimes an actual surprise to me where I notice my breath and I'm like, oh, that's right. Look at you.
That old pal.
Been going up and down all day. Look at you.
Well, let's get reacquainted here, shall we?
Yes. So it's a nice way to let go of everything for some moments, all of our worries and concerns, and just let go. So get comfortable. Close your eyes. And then just notice your breath, like glancing easily in the direction of your breath. You're not controlling it or trying to change it. You're just looking at it. And you'll have thoughts. You're not trying to get rid of thoughts. Your mind will wander into your thoughts. And when you notice that, you just glance back at your breath again. Just let go. Go ahead and open your eyes.
It's funny. Here's something in breathing that I think everybody is necessarily very well practiced at. Mm-hmm. And when all you do is notice it, you know, you can breathe even better, but you can also think, hey, here's something I'm good at. And that feels good all on its own.
A tiny victory.
Hey. Yeah, it's a, so to speak, right?
Man, I'm good at this. Yeah, oh. I mean, and that's the thing. And if you can't, there's other things to be concerned about than meditation. And if you can, it's like, oh, it's like to be grateful and to, I don't know. It, yeah, right. There's a lot in just noticing. And it is This is too much, and I hate when I sound cheeseball, but when you teach meditation, it's hard to completely get away from. But it's a natural wonder.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, your own breath is a natural, the same way like an amazing waterfall you might hike 2 hours to get to. Like your breath, it's keeping everything going. It was given to you by your mother. Like it was it was passed down since the first person of your lineage. Like it's
It's like naturally occurring. It is. It is. And that's why the vampires are so jealous.
Oh.
Vampires are terrible at meditation.
That's why.
That's why. I've got the secrets here. Come to the right place. Laura House is the co-host, along with Annabelle Gerwich, of the Tiny Victories podcast here on Maximum Fun. You can find out more about Laura and her work at laurahouse.com. Laura, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, Sarah Marshall's work is all about showing you what you're wrong about in history. And now she's doing something new.
I just started therapy for the first time in my adult life, so I feel like that has opened a door. The denial is strong in me and the masochism is strong in me. I know this is bullshit, but I still feel it. I'm like, what if my brain gets taken away? What if I lose my individuality? What if I become the mom robot, the mombi that I felt like people wanted? And what if I become a perfect sixth grader? I guess it's too late for that. I'm too old.
Well, I'm here to tell you, Sarah Marshall, you're wrong about that. that's not what's going to happen.
How the turntables.
From the podcast You're Wrong About, Sarah Marshall joins us. If people support our show through a small donation, we can keep being here together. If not, it ends. We can't. We shut down. If you already donate, you make Depression Mode happen. Thank you. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. You can find a level that works for you. MaximumFun.org/join. Be sure to hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do that now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting conversations going. Please know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Please use our electric mail address, depressionmode@maximumfun.org, to drop us a line if there's something on your mind, if you have concerns, if you have compliments, if you have pie recipes. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search it up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hello, credits listeners. Depression Mode has now been a thing for a year. Thank you so much for celebrating our 1 year anniversary just by listening to this particular episode. And thanks for being with us this whole year and for supporting the show financially and emotionally. I think we're doing some good work together, and I'm proud to be working with you. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
This is Mary from Maine, and I just wanted to say, I'm proud of you.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.